Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's episode of Wandering DMs, we have longtime designer and developer for D&D and other fantasy RPGs, as well as the first ever online coordinator for D&D, Sean K. Reynolds. Sean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, appreciate it.
But before we get into it, we should remind our viewers that we have a subscription drive going on right at the moment. And if you go to the chat and the description on this video, if you have not followed our YouTube channel to date, if you do so right now, you'd be in the running for a whole lot of swag and prizes that we're giving away. So please check out that subscription drive. And if you can't see that, go to wanderingdms.com and you'll immediately see the subscription drive at the top of the page.
That's right. I've just posted the link to the chat for everyone, and I'll just point out if you're already subscribed, you can still enter. Just follow the link, and there are multiple ways to enter, and you can get into the drawing for some pretty cool stuff.
So, Sean, I guess so your biography with fantasy role playing publishing is so long that I was researching for quite a while before the show started. And just to be clear to our viewers, you have worked on design development for 2nd edition D&D, 3rd edition, for Pathfinder, for Greyhawk, for Forgotten Realms. Now you're with Monty Cook Games, a whole bunch of stuff in Dragon Magazine, Living Greyhawk, stuff like that. And in addition to that, you, as I said, you're the first ever online coordinator. So I guess I can't call you at the time the face of D&D, but I guess you were the written voice of D&D for many, many years when you first joined TSR and then made the switch to Wizards of the Coast. So it seems like you're in a really privileged position to have seen the changes that have happened with online gaming from when you started to today.
Oh, very, very much so. It was a crazy time to join TSR when the internet was just starting to take off outside of colleges. And TSR was starting to go through some really rough times, and that meant there was a lot of people messaging TSR saying, hey, where are my books, or why is this thing late? And I was the aperture for people to reach TSR without having to use a stamp.
Yep. I think that many, like a number of our viewers actually told us when we announced that you would be joining us this week, they said that they've interacted with you previously in that role, as a matter of fact. And to be clear, they just pile on the apologies that I have to give from time to time. So to be clear, if anybody doesn't know, when you joined TSR in the 90s, TSR had no website, had no email domain of their own. You were actually forced to use AOL.com emails. You just told me before the show something I didn't realize is that from the head of the company, it wasn't an oversight, but you were prohibited from having a website for the company, which is blowing my mind. And then in addition to that, something I of course totally knew was at the time there players and fans were expressly prohibited from sharing fan-based content online, or at least TSR was claiming that they owned everything that anybody ever put online. So, of course, now you've seen the switch to open gaming license when Atkinson bought D&D, and now we have DMs Guild, in which the company allows everybody to use any piece of IP, character, place, location, world, and I will never get over that. My brain will never get accustomed to the fact that they allow everybody to do that.
Yeah, it's a big change.
What for you has been the biggest surprise in how things have evolved from when you started to today?
Well, I mean, it was a different world in 95 when I started. Like, the idea of people having their full-time job being streaming, playing D&D or other RPGs was just, no one had ever thought that would be a thing. Like, at the time, you might be able to get a few people together on your AOL chat or in some sort of, like, IRC chat to play, you know, D&D online. Mm. But the fact that now shows like Critical Role are so much more popular that people know D&D. They heard about D&D from Critical Role. Like, how crazy is that? Yeah. It's just a different world.
Do you have any projections? Do you foresee any further development of where streaming is going to take role-playing games?
Well, you know, it's like having grown up in the era of video games and having just gotten out of college when the internet really took off as a public thing, I have just learned that anybody's predictions more than a year or two ahead of time are just going to be wildly askew from what actually happens. The fact that we have things like Vine and TikTok and YouTube, and now that we all live on Zoom to do all of our work, no one would have predicted that. So I can't even speculate on that because I'll be wrong and look like a fool.
That's fair.
I'm not being like a fool, but just don't want to throw myself into that fool pit unnecessarily.
I get it. I mean, I remember the funny thing is around that era, I think, is when I first started going to Gen Con. I think my first Gen Con was 92. And I remember just being overwhelmed at the sheer size of it and like seeing the TSR castle on the showroom floor and thinking, this is amazing, this enormous thing. And now looking at pictures at it and you're like, oh, it was actually small right, compared to like conventions today. You're like, no, it's actually kind of small.
Yeah, I mean, Gen Con grew a lot in the 1995 to 2005 era. And then they were struggling a bit, but then they've come back again. But yeah, 95 was the year I joined TSR. And that was my first Gen Con. I lived in Southern California before that, and there were no big game conventions there. Yeah. So I started working at TSR, and it's like, all right, all hands on deck. 1 month later is Gen Con, and we were all working at Gen Con. And the whole, it wasn't a separate company from TSR. We just all start, like, the first couple of years I was at TSR, you literally, there were times where you would come to the booth to buy a ticket for a game, because there was no online registration. You literally had to go to the booth, and we would hand you a physical ticket. And since all of TSR staffed everything, like, there was a time where Monty Cook and I were at the ticket booth at 8 a.m. selling tickets to games for people.
Yep, that's wild.
When did that spin off, actually? Because, I mean, having grown up with TS, you know, getting TSR products, like, I mean, they own Gen Con for 25 years at least, right? It spun off in the early 2000s?
I don't remember the exact year, but I know that in around 2001 or 2002 is when Peter Atkinson left Wizards of the Coast. And not long after that, he bought Gen Con from Wizards of the Coast / Hasbro and made it a separate company.
Yep. Speaking of Peter, so I'm kind of wondering what your involvement was with the shift in the attitude towards IP property. So the shift between you can't publish anything anywhere online that we don't own to today's situation is pretty radical. Did you have input, or were you proselytizing around like opening things up, or did Atkinson and Dancy just come in and it was fiat at that point?
So before I joined TSR, the person in charge of their online presence was this guy named Rob Rep, and he was on the marketing team, and he just happened to know internet stuff. He had an email account, and so the owner said, you are now in charge of our internet presence, even though you already have another job. And through him and through the TSR legal counsel, they came up with the idea of, well, if you express something in D&D format, it belongs to TSR because TSR owns D&D. And before I was hired, I argued with him so much about this.
Okay.
When they opened up the position, like, hey, we're hiring for this, I applied just as a luck. Like, this was never going to go anywhere. And then 2 weeks later, I got a call. We did a phone interview and I got hired. And then my second day after being hired, he quit. And so suddenly I was in charge of all that stuff that I was arguing against. And so my first act was to go to the lawyer and say, what can we do about this? Like, we have this policy. I think it's kind of unreasonable, actually very unreasonable. And at that point is when we stopped doing the threat of cease and desist letters for people posting their own monsters or whatever. And we focused on actual copyright infringement. Like, here's the PDF of, you know, the Council of Worms box set. It's like, yeah, we can't have you doing that. But hey, here's your stats for some weird monster you made. Totally fine. And my coworker, Jim Butler, who was an editor for Forgotten Realms at the time, he was also on board with this. And we kind of mitigated the TSR policy without actually changing the policy. We just kind of mitigated our enforcement of the policy. Mm-hmm. And then when Wizards of the Coast came around, they had a much more benign and open idea of how to handle this sort of thing. And then a year or two later, the D20 system and the open gaming license just blew that door off completely. But I said that when I was hired, like, internally, my two goals were get TSR a website and fix TSR's online policy. There was just several steps over several years to get both of those things to happen.
Well, we're certainly, I mean, that certainly happened. That was like the biggest, most radical shift that I've ever seen for a corporate entity, frankly. So job well done, I would say. So as of today, everything D&D is online and it's all entirely open, basically. So well done with that. I mean, I remember at that time when the open gaming license came out, I mean, my mind was blown. And obviously there was a bit of a bubble as far as indie companies making a product. There was a bit of a glut around that time, but certainly my mind was blown, the idea that you could make and actually fit, you know, it was okay to publish things compatible for D&D officially, and that there was quite a bit of resources available to support that. So it was a real amazing sea change at the time.
You know, I feel like there was, I was going to say a second wave, but maybe just an evolution of this. I remember, Dan, when you and I first got into blogging, which is maybe around the 2008-ish, that's in my head, 2008-ish, that, we were getting back into old school stuff, and there was a chunk of time there where you couldn't get legally in any way any PDF reprints of any of the old stuff, right? And then
original D&D first edition, stuff like that.
Right. Any of the old modules, et cetera, were just could not be found. And then that changed, right? And that is I wasn't sure if that was a change in perspective or just that digital distribution just became easier, or what.
Part of it is that TSR didn't have digital files that could be made into PDFs at the time. Like, we had archives of these old Dragon magazines and things like that were on, you know, like 9-inch floppy disks. And part of the stuff that I did when I was the TSR online coordinator was to get archives of these older Dragon magazine articles scanned and put online. But we didn't have good OCR technology, so I literally just did a crowdsourcing sort of thing. I said, hey, if you have a scanner or if you're willing to type in these old articles, here's a list of articles that we absolutely know that we have the rights to do. Because at the time, Dragon also had some contracts where the author had like given up the first right to print it, but then they retained later rights. So similar things we couldn't actually reproduce under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
But we just went to the community and said, you know, here's a list of articles. If you send me a text file of this, then I will add this to the public archive. If you want to be a hero, help us be heroes and we'll do this. And then at some point, we got a third party company to do scans of some of these old products and convert them to PDFs. And so a lot of those PDFs that are in circulation and were on sale are literally just scans of old print copies of the books.
I guess I really don't find that surprising, right? Like, I felt like at the time that it was less likely to be a policy of, like, we're worried about copyright and you know, piracy and distribution, and more just to, like, what is the cost of digitizing this stuff versus the expected revenue of actually putting it up somewhere for resale.
Yeah. And nowadays, it's just an entirely different market. Like, the idea is like, hey, I'm going to have this back catalog that is always available because it costs me nothing to keep this PDF on sale. And so you just have this little trickle of income, but you have enough of those little trickles and it adds up and it can keep a lot of companies afloat.
Fascinating. Yeah. So Paul William there in the chat is talking about the Dragon Magazine Archive CD-ROM. I don't know if you want to put that up on the... and William, so do I. So so I think this was circa 2000-ish is TSR released this CD-ROM. It's like, I think there's five CDs in here or something like that of all the Dragon magazines up until 250. And to my understanding, they didn't get the licensing rights correct, actually. Is I think that they can't, having done this, I think they got in trouble, particularly with the cartoons, and they couldn't ever republish it because of that.
It's a weird, ambiguous situation, because right around that time, National Geographic magazine had also published its own digital archive of stuff, and the idea was the copyright law said that you could republish something if it was just a shift in formats. You could republish a VHS movie on DVD, or you can republish a physical magazine archive as DVD. And so that was the understanding that TSR did to publish that. But there was a comic, I won't mention their name, but their author said, hey, my contract says that you don't have reproduction rights. And so there was some ambiguity, and it basically meant that was just a one and done for that CD-ROM archive.
Yep.
I think eventually the Supreme Court ruled in favor of National Geographic, and which would be in favor of the Dragon Magazine archive to allow that sort of thing. But yeah, a lot of, basically, when you get in an argument with a lawyer who has nothing to do except argue with your stuff, you're going to just eventually lose, because they will just fight you, and it'll cost you money to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yep, that makes sense. That makes sense. Like, so in an attempt to get away from that kind of thing, the open gaming license that I think mostly Ryan Dancy wrote, I think, was a really big shift. Do you think that was successful in retrospect? So now we're 20 years past the open gaming license. How successful do you think that was, or what you and Dancy thought would become of it at the time?
I think it was incredibly successful, because the way the company worked at the time was that bigger source books were profitable, small adventures were not profitable, or they were barely profitable. It was not worth the company's time to make like 4 32-page adventures versus one 128-page source book. Hmm. And so by allowing the OGL, it meant that all these independent publishers, who were just people working in their off time out of their garage or their basement, whatever, they could take up the burden of writing crazy, interesting new adventures that for them would be profitable, because they didn't have an entire art department and human resources department and all these other things. And TSR, or Wizards of the Coast, could focus on making the big books that were profitable for them. And so it was basically externalizing a lot of the costs of, we need to have adventures so people will play the game, but we can't make them in a profitable way. We'll focus on this. And it basically meant that all these independent publishers who had been tinkering with their own games or had been working on other games, they suddenly said, wow, I can get money out of D&D. And so all these publishers started making D&D, which meant that all of their fans and followers started playing D&D. And so it became not quite a monopoly, but a bigopoly of everyone playing D&D in the early 2000s. And it did lead to a glut of quite often mediocre or bad products. But the net effect was, for Wizards of the Coast, everybody knew about D&D, everybody knew how to play D&D, and you could walk into any game store, find a D&D book, and find a D&D game group, which was incredibly successful for the company.
So what's your viewpoint then on sort of what's currently happening with DM's Guild? Is this just a replay of exactly what we saw in that period, but in the digital form? Or is it different?
I mean, it's very similar. And because PDF publishing is so prominent now, it's cheaper to make a PDF than it is to make a print product. Like, it literally, you can put together a PDF in a weekend. You sit down, you write it, you have your friend edit it, you get some stock art, boom, and it's available 3 days later. Whereas if you have to print it, you have to go and send it out to a printer, you have to check the proofs, then you have to get into the distribution network or have a warehouse in your garage where you can mail order stuff. Just doing PDF only is so simple. And it just means that many more creative people can be out there making interesting things for the D&D network or for whatever company. There are a lot of other companies that do that sort of thing. Even Monte Cook Games has its own thing called the Cypher System Creator Program, where people can publish stuff for Cypher System or for The Strange and so on. And just the idea is, yes, we know that this is a creative hobby. People like to create stuff for the games that they play. Why not give them the opportunity to publish that, share it with other people, and make a little money? And it incentivizes them to keep loving your game.
I bet there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of young people getting in the hobby right now that can't imagine it ever being different than that. And it was exactly the opposite. It was exactly the opposite when you got started. And I feel a little bit of old man disease about, like, in my day, if you wanted to write your own D&D thing, you had to go uphill two ways, 5 miles, to fight off an owl bear. It was that hard. So,
well, I think it's interesting because you say the same thing happen in the music industry. Like, the music publishers, they had, like, a chokehold and everything, and then Napster came out and people were just sharing music illegally all the time, and now you can do your own playlists, you can make your own mixes of things, and it's all there because they realized, we can make money off this, we don't have to throttle that network of money and talent. We can just allow more people to come in and they'll just take a little piece of it, because capitalism, yay!
I gotta say, it was the company that Paul and I actually met. It was the video game company that Paul and I met. That I have a very concrete memory of my specific being at my desk and having someone come over and show me Napster for the first time, and having this explosive moment of, like, oh, that's what the future is going to be like. Oh my God. And I have a very, very distinct memory of that particular moment at that particular desk in that space. So. There are particular things that have happened in our careers that have, the world was not the same after that particular day.
Yeah. And I'm still a bit of a grognard. Like, if there's a movie I like, I will purchase it. So I have it on Amazon or whatever. Yeah. And my girlfriend and her son are like, why are you buying movies? They are streaming on Netflix and HBO and Hulu and this and that. Like, why? I'm like, no, but I want to have this one.
It's just a different
world.
I'd say likewise. Yeah. I think, like, you know, beyond just digital distribution of PDFs, I think that print on demand is actually also huge, because even though it is so much easier to produce just a PDF and it is so much easier to get them, I feel like the audience is actually wider for print product. My theory here is backed up by my wife is a academic librarian, so works at a university and in interlibrary loan, and pretty much all the time, her patrons would prefer the print copy to a digital copy where that's possible.
Huh.
Yeah. And a lot of people just, they really like having the physical copy. And I've done print on demand stuff, and it's great. Yeah. Just the idea of, I don't have to have a 1,000 or 2,000 unit run. I can make a little adventure and print as many copies as people need for it. And 10 years down the road, someone says, hey, I would like this. I'm like, I still have the files. I'll do a print on demand. The fact that they're tied to DriveThruRPG, you just be, you guys take care of that, print it. And you don't have to warehouse anything. One of the weird things that I did when I was at TSR during the Wizards transition is there was a warehouse in Texas that was just full of, it was basically the TSR warehouse of all the unsold product. And some of it was 5 or 10 years old. And they sent designer Dave Eckleberry and I and a few other people from TSR to go to this warehouse and help their warehouse inventory team get a count of everything that we had and just get a sense of, oh, this is an adventure. Like, there were adventures that they printed 2,000 copies of back in 1989, and there were still 1,100 copies left.
Oh, yeah,
they're not going to sell an 8-year-old adventure from something 2 game systems ago. So why keep this around? We don't need to pay to warehouse 1,000 copies of an old adventure. But nowadays you can just have a digital copy of that and print it if you need it. And it's we live in the future.
and you're right with the connection of music too. When I first moved to New York, I was pursuing a punk band for a couple of years pretty seriously, and we toured and stuff like that. And at the time, in order to release it, we made CDs. The smallest manufacturing CD order we could make was 1,000. And fast forward about 10 years, and I have the majority of 1,000 CDs stored in my basement. And I had to go through and rip them all open and separately recycle the plastic and the CDs and the cases. And so that exact same process. And obviously no one would do that. No indie band would do that nowadays. So, totally good. All right, let's get away from IP publishing stuff and dig into some D&D rules debates or things like that. So Sean, one question I like to ask all of our guests is, what for you personally, what system did you start playing role-playing games with? D&D, something else?
I started with the D&D box set, the Tom Moldvay. The red box, not the Frank Mentzer box, but the other one. And then we switched to playing.
I think if you look closely behind Paul, that's the big box on the shelf.
Yeah, the
big fans of Moldvay.
And then started playing the expert set, and then my cousin and I picked up the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Dungeon Master's Guide, and we're like, all these crazy weird magic items, and there's artifacts, you can choose your own powers, and so it was first edition D&D after that. But yeah, the, those old original D&D box sets had such a strong influence on me that my little indie RPG that I wrote, Five Moons RPG, did the layout and used the fonts of those old games because it's just back there in my heart, in my head.
Lovely.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, we're really big fans of
Frontiers and Tunnels and Trolls and a little bit of Traveler, that sort of thing. But it's, I've basically been a D&D guy from the very start.
Great. And we're huge fans of Mold Bay Basic. So in our heart of hearts, I tend to do original D&D, the little brown books with some house rules, and Paul tends to play Mold Bay with some house rules. And over years, our house rules came, so we were actually just running the same system over time. And Tom Mold Bay did such a great job with that, and there's such great art from Errol Otis and other people on that set.
Yeah.
And I think for most of us did the same thing that you did, Sean, of grab the AD&D stuff and just kind of mash it together into like sort of one single game. So I think that's a common trope that we hear guests tell us is exactly that. That's nice to hear.
Second edition Player's Handbook came out, and we used that with our first edition Monsters and Dungeon Master's Guide, just because we liked having all of the spells all in one place from all these different sources. So we were already mixing editions like fools.
You know, I think that's actually a real key need. And I mean, I have two or three little indie products that I put together. One I just call Book of Spells, and it's that. It's for original classic D&D, just one book with all the spells in one place, and I can hand it around to players and stuff like that. And I agree, creating new spells is great, but then you go forward a year or two, and then you have this problem of like now it's in a whole bunch of different books and stuff like that. So I totally that's totally a big reason to use Dave Cook's edit there of AD&D.
Because we were pulling in stuff from Arduin and the Tome of Mighty Magic and all these other weird third-party publishers, which were like, you know, at the time, I'm sure TSR would have sued them if they caught them, but they were just kind of fly-by-night.
So after that time, you have gotten the chance to do design development for 2nd edition, 3rd edition, Pathfinder, Greyhawk, Forgotten Realms, Monty Cook Games. What are, like, the top three favorite products? And I gotta say this, like, one of my favorite things that you've done is the Scarlet Brotherhood supplement for Greyhawk. Actually, we were on the Jay Scott's Lord Gasumba Twitch show a couple weeks back. He said, what's your favorite Greyhawk product? And I actually mentioned your Scarlet Brotherhood product. I thought that was really super well done, actually. But for you, what are your top two or three favorite products you've gotten a chance to work on?
Well, I was the developer for the original Numenera book, which I was greatly appreciative of Monty giving me that opportunity. But having worked with him at TSR and Wizards of the Coast, he knew that I had a really good sense for the rules. And so when he and Shauna were making Numenera, he's like, I was not an employee. I did this as a contractor. He's like, Sean, can you do me a favor and look at the rules of my new Numenera game? And so I was a developer on Numenera. And then fast forward 6 years, Bruce and I and Monty and Shauna, we were rewriting Numenera to be a Numenera. Sorry, I've got a cat wanting to get a keyboard here. to be Numenera Discovery and Destiny. And so here I am, like, developing rules that I worked on before, and with, like, you know, 6 more years of experience and hopefully wisdom. We had a great time working on the Forgotten Realms campaign setting because it was Skip Williams, who's representing classic AD&D, myself, representing one of the New Blood sort of guys, Rob Hainso, also another New Blood sort of guy, and then working with Ed Greenwood, the master of, you know, like, great. I remember reading, there were Forgotten Realms articles that Ed wrote in Old Dragon magazines that literally say, they were just like pages from the mages, and he'd say, blah, blah, blah. Well, in my campaign, the Forgotten Realms, because this is before it was a setting, this is just Ed talking about his home game.
Yep.
So the four of us working together on this book, where we were taking all this Forgotten Realms lore and translating it into third edition D&D and saying, oh, we have this opportunity to do this, and it was great. We had this 1-week-long summit in Ontario to spend time talking to Ed and just brainstorming for 8 hours a day. That was just so incredible. And even now, I mean, that book won an award, and I'm not really big on awards, but I'm just so proud of that book. And a lot of the Greyhawk stuff that we did, the Living Greyhawk Gazetteer, I love gathering up stuff, and just the existence of a new rule set is really an opportunity to say, okay, I can take all the stuff that I really, really like from the previous version of this and fully embrace this new rule set and make something really, really cool. And I don't want to put my fingerprints all over something like I own it, but I do like to have a little bit of nuance here and there to say, oh, this is my special twist of that. And that sort of thing led to, that led to the Forgotten Realms, and Scarlet Brotherhood was a lead into that. That's some of the first books that I worked on. It's a very nostalgic period for me. It's hard for me to pick out. I'm glad that you asked me to choose three, because it's hard for me to pick one. The Scarlet Brotherhood in particular is a funny one, because last year I wrote, and it was published this year, a book called Stay Alive for the Cypher System, which is the Cypher System Guide to Horror, because I'm a big horror fan. I've been a horror fan since I was, in junior high and high school. But after writing Stay Alive, I really had to go and do a purge and just focus on light, happy stuff for a while, because I had spent 3 months just absorbing horror from all systems. The Scarlet Brotherhood was the same way, because I'm like, oh, I have to write about these people who are a horrible racist, committing genocide and doing all this eugenic stuff and inbreeding monsters. These are really bad people. I need to do something really happy in life by comparison to that.
I was impressed by how hardcore it was. And actually, on this show, actually, we come back to horror themes quite a lot, actually. Paul runs a lot of horror games. We talk about it. I mean, H.P. Lovecraft's birthday was just 2 weeks ago, and I wrote a big blog post arguing that he is really the root of all the pulp traditions that Gygax was talking about in the first edition DMG, actually. So we come back to that quite a lot ourselves. Do you think that like a product like Scarlet Brotherhood could be published today, or is it? Do you think it's too hardcore to get published by Wizards these days?
Yeah, wow. I mean, it is currently a controversial product. People look back at it now like, wow, there's a lot of colonialism in that, and a lot of perspective. But the thing is, Scarlet Brotherhood presented as evil, but it's also written from the perspective of the people who are the Scarlet Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. So all that colonial stuff is in there because the Scarlet Brotherhood believes that they are the superior race and they want to colonize the rest of the world and subjugate these inferior races. But without someone being aware of that, that could really be seen as a horrible and offensive sort of thing, because it's a horrible and offensive perspective. And we have to be very aware that when we are doing something like that, we inform people, hey, this is like any sort of help. Jojo Rabbit, the movie that came out, it's about a little boy who idolizes Hitler, and his imaginary friend is Hitler. And if you don't understand that Taika Waititi is making fun of Hitler in this, you might think he's glorifying the Nazi youth and stuff, and he's not. He's saying these are bad people. This is a bad perspective for this boy to have. You just have to be throw that out. No, this is, I'm going to tell you, this is bad. And so in that context, here's what I'm showing you.
Right.
You have to be really careful to publish that today.
That makes a lot of sense. And I've seen, obviously, there's been, attempts to criticize even Mel Brooks, the producers, in the same vein recently. So it is, you're right. It's a thing we're all having to learn to navigate more carefully these days, perhaps. That's a good perspective.
I think the people who are trying to be sensitive about that are being very upfront about content warnings for the material that they're presenting.
Yeah, there you go. Seems smart. So you were pretty involved in the early thousands with the third edition, both the rules, the development, the online presence. You made some monsters, the monster manual, and stuff like that. We, Paul and I, with our friends, played third edition pretty heavily. So I think we had a campaign that ran routinely for about seven, eight years or something like that.
Yep.
So we were certainly reading your rules advice at the time, Sean, and we were using a spreadsheet that you made for equipment generation that was kind of complicated in third edition, actually. And I remember that you were the first person that I ever read with the rule about how to deal with diagonal squares on a grid. about counting, you know, one and two and one and two and sure. that kind of thing. So I remember you using quite a lot of your rulings at the time. One of the funniest things to me when I think about like third edition rules evolution is when they went from 3 to 3.5, and having worked on like my own spells edits, probably the single trickiest spell in the whole system is polymorph, right? And so yeah. with 3.5, by the end of it, you finally errated polymorph was actually banned from the whole system, written out of the whole system. And there were so many supplements that you were trying to write errata for that Wizards set up a special email just solely for polymorph errata. And there was an email, polymorph@wizards.com, that I believe went to you just for people to send in sightings of polymorph references in any supplement that hadn't been errated yet. Were you receiving the emails to polymorph@wizards?
You know, I don't remember that. I don't know if it's because it's after I left Wizards or just because I blanked it out with a lot of drinking. Like anything in the game that lets you do anything, like I mean capital A anything, is going to be a problem. Yeah. Like even the wish spell, which has a list of bullet points of things that it can and can't do, it's a ninth level spell. Polymorph is what, fourth level? And so it's already going to be like, oh, we need to get past this situation. I'm going to turn you into a troll because you can do this thing. And Pathfinder, again, in inheriting a lot of that baggage, had to deal with that problem too. It's just, it's funny to look at stuff in the game that was in the game at the time and converting it to a new system, because I'm working on a conversion of the tallest campaign setting that Monty wrote for third edition, and we're converting it to 5e and the Cypher system. And there's so much stuff in 3e Tallis that is specified that nowadays we're like, we don't even care. Like the idea of this spell has to have the good descriptor because it's a good spell. Because there are things in the rules interface, whether it's the good spell or it's not. And now that isn't even a thing. And we're like, oh, we don't even care about that. Because we realize that
Do you feel like third edition like went overboard with that kind of formalization in hindsight?
I don't know. I wouldn't. I'm sorry if you can hear my cat howling in the background. He wants to get into the rest of the house.
Well, it could have been any one of us. Like, I almost said, here, someone's cat is yowling, and it could be mine, Paul's, or Sean's. It's equally likely. So that'll happen from time to time.
Yeah. It's Malachi. The design philosophy of 3E was that the GM has a lot of work to do. And if we can codify a lot of stuff in the game, like how far can you jump, or how hard is it to climb this kind of wall, or you know, is a secret door about this difficult? The more that we can hard code that into the rules so the GM isn't having to make rulings, we can push a lot of that stuff, the burden of that work, onto the players so the GM can focus on the story. And unfortunately, that had the net effect of you had players saying, nuh-uh, this wall is supposed to be a DC 17 climb check. Why did I fail when I rolled a 17? And the GM's like, a ghost. A wizard did it. Yeah. You know, you have a cold. Like, it really took away some of the GM's power to make arbitrary rulings of, oh, you know, you don't know why this is not DC 17. It's a little harder than normal. Oh, it's a little easier than normal. Why is that? Should you be suspicious? It pushed a lot of that ability onto the players to give the GM the power of narrative control to focus on the story. I do think it went kind of wild on detailing every single thing. Like, one of the things I'm dealing with in Tallis right now is you had to detail like the hardness of doors and how many hit points doors had and how many hit points walls had, just in case that someone would use a pickaxe or a spell to chop through a wall or a door instead of just kicking the door down or opening the door. It's like, do we really need to have a page of rules about this is what a wooden door's hit points is, this is what a stone door's hit points is, and so on? It's just like, can we just let some of that be?
Uh-oh.
Sorry, cat got it.
And he
cat literally got your tongue.
Yeah. So there is some of that stuff that does not need to be called out. Some of that stuff can just be, oh, something with the GM wings. So yeah, I think it did go a little over the top, but the intention was very good.
Personally, I think it's well done. I mean, frankly, still to this day, actually, when I'm even running original D&D, I have my third edition handbook by my side, and it's actually pretty common for something like jumping for me to go grab it, look up the difficulty levels, which I think were pretty well analyzed, and then convert it to something simpler, is what I do quite a lot. Yeah. So I think that's a pretty good analysis of it. It was well thought out. I was very impressed when I first saw it, and then maybe a couple of years down the line, it makes not a great culture for between players and DM, maybe. Yeah.
Now, so you mentioned the jumping rules. I have a funny anecdote about that, because the original jumping rules, you could not jump nearly as far as you could now. It was like the base distance was like 2 feet plus your strength mod or something like that. Yep. And so diagonally over from my cube was Jonathan Tweet's cube, and Jonathan was primarily in charge of the PH. Monty was primarily in charge of the Dungeon Master's Guide, and Rich was primarily in charge. Skip was in charge of the Monster Manual. And so, having looked at those jumping rules, I said, Jonathan, these are not good enough. Look, I'm not an athletic person, but I'm 6 feet tall, 6 foot one, and I can routinely jump 6 feet over and over again to a standing broad jump. And I just did it like 20 times in a row without fail. I jumped 6 feet. I said, you need the base distance of jumping to be 6 feet or equal to the person's height. And Jonathan, after watching me jump 20 times, is like, you're right, I'll change that.
I love that kind of pragmatic testing. Yeah. Viewers of our channel may know I recently did a test of how quickly I could drink various sized liquids to try and figure out how much liquid is actually in a potion. You know, it kind of reminds me of working in video games. I used to work in a line of cubicles that was right next to the animators, and they would routinely get up into the hallway and run around like lunatics. And I'd be like, what's going on? Oh, it's the animators. They're trying to figure out what does it look like if I, you know, jump and swing my sword over my head and then spin in a circle.
You know, I actually felt, you know, because I do go to the third edition rules because I had the instinct that somebody had done that, to be perfectly frank, Sean. I just looking at the jumping rules, I felt someone has done some amount of research because these are pretty good. Paul and I are currently we're in post production for a show, a tournament D&D show that we're going to release in the fall, called The Big Bad, and we have competitor teams, and we had like Luke Gygax was on a team and some people like that, and jumping was an important part. There was a particular aspect where jumping was pretty important in the scenario that we were running all these teams through, and Paul and I had a couple debates about the specific difficulty level at one point, and I was actually arguing that the third edition rules actually had better rules than fifth edition. Actually, it's a kind of a subtle point, but that was actually a really critical part of our The Big Bad scenario that we've been running the last couple of weeks. So I'm with you. I agree with experimentation. I think that was the right call.
Yeah.
Are you finally convinced, Paul?
Yeah. You know, the fact is that we had teams coming to play a fifth edition game. They expect to know how the rules work, right? And there's a little push and pull there of, yeah. But I'm happy. I'm happy with where we landed.
It's a funny bit about games like D&D, because if you are a first or second level character, you're dealing with normal people, like human people. And when you're a player coming into that environment, you need to have the game be able to simulate reality enough so that if a player comes across a 5 foot gap, like a 5 foot chasm, they know, they have a good sense of whether or not they can make that jump. Otherwise, the player's going to say, okay, there's a 1 foot hole in the ground. Am I able to jump that? I don't know, because I don't know how well the game is modeling reality. But then you get into like mid-level and high-level stuff, and you literally have characters who can become immune to swords if they get angry enough, and reality just goes out the door. Yeah. So you spend a lot of time defining this baseline stuff, and then you can just throw it away. It's a really weird, like, people talk about mid-level play and high-level play as being different than low-level play and where your sweet spot is, and that's part of that. It's just where the game starts to get weird about what you can and can't do.
Now, I will admit that some, you know, modern systems and modern players might actually disagree with that and argue that even beginning characters should immediately be in this elite class that's not like the rest of the world. Our instinct that you just said, Sean, is, you know, classic D&D traditional type stuff. And personally, I prefer that because for a completely brand new player, I can have someone come to the table and their instincts about what their sense of the world is the same as their characters in these kind of mundane, how heavy is a sword, how high can I jump, how fast is a horse kind of things. And I like first level D&D characters to be normal people, because then I can introduce brand new players to the game without a whole bunch of rules mechanics being explained because it's a fantasy. So I prefer that, even though some people try to get away from it. I think that's a mistake, frankly.
I think it's just the premise of kind of the default sort of campaign you're running. Like the default sort of D&D is your first level wizard is just that apprenticeship. Your first level fighter is literally like a farmer, farm boy, farm girl who was swinging a sword in their off days. But there are different paradigms in different games. Like I worked on at Interplay an adaptation. We're going to make an Exalted video game. And we came up to them with an initial plot and some encounters. And White Wolf came back and said, this is not powerful enough because a starting character in an Exalted game can punch out a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Okay.
That's a brand new character. It's tough enough to do that. So like, oh, okay, so you're not going to have a fight where you're fighting three mooks. You're going to have a fight where you're fighting 50 mooks. It's a very different experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really about setting expectations, right? Like if you can, and especially I think it's important if you can just boil that down to a very quick sentence so you don't have to spend 2 hours setting expectations. I always liked, for our style of game that Dan and I like to run, I always like Matt Finch's analogy of you're not Superman, you're Batman. And you're not actually starting as Batman, you aspire to eventually become Batman. So that's our starting point, is I aspire someday to be Batman.
Yeah, and if you have a player who thinks they're going to start playing as Batman or they're going to start playing as Superman, they're going to be disappointed. You have to go and frame their expectations as to what they're going to play.
Right.
But it's totally fine to say, hey, you're Superman, you're Batman, you're Aquaman, you're Wonder Woman, and you're all badasses. Let's go.
Right.
Let's talk about what you've been doing lately on staff with Monte Cook Games, like with Numenera. Where is that starting level for that game? Is it like what I would consider classic D&D, or is it something higher level than that?
It's a little higher than that. Like, so in Numenera we have tiers, we don't have levels, and characters go from tier 1 to tier 6, and it's not quite as much of an extreme like level 1 to 20 as D&D has, but a tier 1 character is pretty competent. Like, they are still... like, they might have to hit a door a couple of times to knock it open, but they have abilities that regular characters don't have. And that's actually part of the reason why Numenera has tiers for characters and levels for NPCs and monsters, so that you can say, this typical villager is a level 2 person, but your tier 1 character is better than them. Like, a tier 1 can easily defeat a level 2 creature. It's not... You need multiple tier 2 creatures to do that. So you're up there a little bit. But it lets us do some really fun stuff. Like, the book that is just back from the printer for Numenera is called Liminal Shore. And Bruce had this really creative idea. My co-author, Bruce Cordell, was the lead on this book. And the idea of Liminal Shore is it's a part of the world where everything is alive. Like, obviously, the people are alive, the animals are alive, but the ground is alive, the buildings are alive, your weapons are alive, your clothing is alive.
You have this
symbiotic relationship with everything is alive. Like, the mountains are gigantic organisms that sleep for, you know, dozens of years at a time, but they can wake up and decide to move somewhere. You might have a town that has a river flowing near it, and the river is actually like a collection of gigantic gelatinous amoeba-like creatures that you can drink. And you don't kill them by doing that. They just kind of live in you, and then they become incorporated in your body, and their life force becomes part of yours. And so it's this crazy paradigm where literally everything is alive. And so you, instead of having magic items and artifacts that are like, this is a steel sword, you might have a sword that's made of bone, but it's a living creature. And you can, it'll like weave itself into your body, or, you know, you can, it's just, it's so bizarre out there. And it's, we're always trying to push boundaries with Numenera, because it's just such a strange environment. And the Liminal Shore book is just, and the funny thing is, the twist of Liminal Shore is that everything is alive. There's actually another twist beyond that we're not talking about, because we don't want to spoil it, but like, finding everything is alive is one of the first things that you will realize when you come to this part of the world. It's just, it's a weird place.
Wow. When you, so Paul pulled up the Liminal Shore cover, the product there that's on screen right now. And what a great setting. And when I flipped through what you sent us before the show, this is some of the best artwork I have ever seen in my life. I guess a lot of it's
really
by Federico Massetti. Yeah.
Oh, he's amazing.
Paul, can you draw up the image?
How about that one? Yeah.
Yes, that one. Thank you. That is just really made my jaw drop on the floor when I first saw it. That is really amazing.
Yeah. our art director, Bear Wider, is just really good at finding incredibly talented artists and getting their best work out of them. We made an XP deck because we hand out XP in the form of cards. It's a different sort of mechanic than what D&D uses. But we feature a piece of art on each of these XP cards because part of the idea is that the GM could just go, oh, I'm going to use this really cool piece of art as a scene for this encounter or this adventure. It's just there.
Okay.
We try and make really inspiring art just to show how amazing and weird the setting is.
It definitely comes through when I saw that particular piece that's on screen right now. It's clearly bizarre and out there and something very different, and I was immediately attracted to it. So it definitely makes me want to dig into that setting. That's fantastic. It sounds like you do a lot of work with Bruce Cordell. Is that like a lot of your recent products with him?
Yes. Yeah. Bruce and I usually split. I'm sorry, upstairs, that was really loud. We usually split a lot of the work on things. Every now and then we'll have like one project that's completely me or completely him. But Bruce and I do most of the stuff for Numenera. Monty mostly works on Invisible Sun and whatever the next new big thing that we're doing on. He's really about coming up with the concept for the next game we're doing on. And Shauna has done a lot of Invisible Sun stuff, and also she just finished her book We're All Mad Here, which is about fairy tales and mental illness, like my book Stay Alive is about horror, and Bruce's book The Stars Are Fire is about science fiction. So her fairy tales book is just coming out, and it is neat and weird and can be fun and playful and creepy. So we each have our own specialties, but Bruce and I work together a lot on the Cypher System and Numenera stuff.
It's funny how much our interests dovetail, actually, because Paul just last week published on DM's Guild a fairy tale based 5th edition venture called Mirror Mirror. So we've been grappling with these same themes recently. Isn't that right, Paul?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think with the season also, I'm starting to think about a lot of horror stuff. You know, the closer we get to Halloween, the more I want to run more horror.
Interesting. Now, the product that Monty Cook Games, I think, published pretty recently that I'm personally the most interested in is the monster book Beasts of Flesh and Steel that you and Bruce did. And it's funny because I feel like as soon as I saw this, I was like, why aren't there more products in this line? So for me, this is clearly a mashup of things that go back to Gygax with the Barrier Peaks adventure,
right?
Or Jim Ward with Metamorphosis Alpha, obviously, right? And right at the outstart of D&D, there was really more of a mashup of sci-fi and fantasy, and as time goes, and obviously in the literature too, those weren't separated genres at one point. And as time goes on, people feel more hardcore that those are clearly separate things. But why not have more robots in your D&D, I say?
Right, exactly. And some people hate that, but some people love it. They just want, you know, their D&D to be a melting pot of everything. So Beasts of Flesh and Steel is actually the third product in that line. We had a Kickstarter, which was basically about converting our Numenera content to 5th edition. And so the first book, Arcana of the Ancients, covers like converting all the ciphers and artifacts into magic items and that sort of thing, and has some creatures in it. It has a lot of character options for in the Numenera game, you have a thing called your focus, which is kind of like a flavored thing that it gets added to your type, which is kind of like your class. And so your focus might be, oh, my character fuses flesh and steel, which means I have like robotics in me, or I wield mental power, so I'm a psychic sort of character. And so Bruce introduced this concept called Iron Flesh, which is, so the idea of AOTA, Arcana of the Ancients, is that something has happened that has awakened these archives of ancient technology that predates the elves, predates the dragons. So like your elf character is like, I've never even heard of this stuff. It's so ancient and so weird that it's just completely alien. But it is science fiction that is so strange that it is basically fantasy. And Arcana of the Ancients gives you the rules for like, hey, I want my fighter character, my 10th level fighter who's got a magic sword, I'm going to get this weird sort of nanobot injection that makes my skin turn metallic and I can enhance my strength. Or, yes, I'm a wizard, but I also have some sort of mechanical device in my head that lets me project fire out of my eyes. And so it just blends magic and technology. So that was the first book. The second one actually takes our Numenera setting, the Ninth World setting, and presents it as a 5e setting. And that is called Beneath the Monolith, because this thing called the Amber Monolith is a key point in the setting. And there's a... It's mostly a setting book. There's a few more creatures in there, but Beasts of Flesh and Steel is just 100%. Here is a whole bunch of crazy ass Numenera monsters, a lot of which are robots or cyborgs or that sort of thing, and we're just doing 5e stats for them. And that we just got back from the printer, and I think it's going to start fulfilling to backer soon, and it'll be available from the MCG store and in game stores. And it's all of our crazy, gorgeous Numenera art, and it's 192 pages of new D&D monsters. And whether or not you use Arcana of the Ancients, you could just say, hey, this is some weird-ass monster that some mad wizard made, or legacy of some other dimension. It's all just weird stuff that your players are not going to be able to predict at all. It's fun.
I feel like books full of monsters are always really good, I think, at being adaptable across systems or across editions even, right? Like we were talking earlier about, you know, mashing up just different editions of D&D, and I'm reminded of how the first edition Monsters Manual was like the first book in that series to come out and possibly predated a lot of actual rules, and maybe is more, in some cases, is more in line with OD&D than it is with first edition D&D, but kind of doesn't matter, right? It's very easy. Even when I'm running BX, when I'm running basic D&D or original D&D, I'll often have a first edition Monsters Manual on hand, just because why not?
Nice.
It's very easy to just pull monsters out. So yeah, I could totally see having this, and like, yeah, I want some weird robots in my D&D. Why not bring them in?
And one fun thing we did for the book is a lot of the pages of monsters have little quotes. We have this elf and this dwarf who are like talking about learning about the Numenera, all this ancient technology. And the elf is very much like, wow, this is really fascinating. I think I would like to try to talk to this creature. And the dwarf's like, nope, don't do it. It's going to kill us.
That's great.
But
it gives
the GM, you know, a way to say, oh, this is how my players might react is A or B. And it just, you know, even if you can even use these two characters as like sages who are like, oh yeah, we've been studying this, and you just have a wandering encounter with this elf and this dwarf, and the elf is like, these are great. And the dwarf is like, I want to go home. These things scare me.
I like the idea. I mean, from the old Dragon articles, either Sage Advice or Ed Greenwood stuff or the Ecology of, I like which used to be like, here's the sage telling you the facts. I like this twist of like, here's two sages in dispute. It's like face versus face, sage versus sage perspective on it. That's a really neat take, actually.
I mean, it totally mirrors
the elf is very much.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the elf's perspective is for Numenera, the game, and we put this into these 5e products as well, is that often the treasure that you get is stuff that you salvage from one of these cyborg-like creatures. Or even if it's completely organic, you're like, oh, this thing has a weird organ that if you squeeze it, it'll make a burst of fire, right? That sort of thing. And so the elf is looking at it like, oh, I wish this creature's eye didn't decay so quickly. I'm hoping that like the enhanced vision that it gives the creature is something that I can implement as a cipher. And the dwarf is like, I'm just glad it tastes like beef.
I was going to say, it completely mirrors the way players actually behave at the table, right? I mean, just last night in my regular D&D game, I had my players fighting a Medusa who's shouting things in a language they don't understand during the fight. And I've got one player saying, like, don't we have a scroll of tongues? Let's get that out. Let's talk to her. And another player's like, I hit her with my axe.
My axe will do the talking.
Yeah.
Sean, what is your fate in the last couple of minutes we have? What is your favorite monster from Beasts of Flesh and Steel?
So there's this thing that I wrote for the Numenera Bestiary, Ninth World Bestiary 3. It was because an Argost, A-R-G-O-Z-T, doesn't sound like ghost, but it is kind of a griffin-like creature with this weird cybernetic set of rings on its back, and there's this glowing ball of light in the middle of it, this glowing ball of energy, that this creature is intelligent. It's called, and it refers to this thing as its light, and it can use it to teleport, and it will take a rider, but it has this ancient pact. If you know the words to the pact, it is required to like serve you for a while, but you have to treat it with respect. And so a lot of people would be like, oh, is this weird monster? It's kind of like a griffin. Whoa, it's teleporting. Whoa, it's talking to me. But then if this, you know, the sage-oriented character can figure out this thing, that these creatures will be like, oh, all right, we'll take you there. But don't talk to me like I'm an animal, buddy. They're just fun. I mean, neat. Numenera is so odd that you can just incorporate technology in weird ways. There's another creature called a Baug that is kind of like chimp level intelligence, but it has these machine implants that if it's near an AI, it can link up to that and it gets smarter. And so its inclination is to find these places and link up so it can kind of be like a stupid human level of intelligence. And they're like, we'll do whatever you want. Just let us sit near this machine so we can be smart.
I gotta say, you know, there's a lot of monsters. There's a lot of monster books that come out, and I feel like, yeah, I've seen this. I get what's going to happen. It's going to have one special ability, and it's going to shoot fire. I get it. And for some reason, I look at Beast of Flesh and Steel, and like, I'm scared because I have really no idea. Like, it feels sharp and edgy, and like, I have no idea what to predict. And like, if I was a player, like, I feel scared all over again because I literally have no idea what the hell you're about to say next, Sean.
That's fantastic.
I'm glad.
So we are about out of time here, Sean. Is there anything else, any final thoughts or other work on Numenera you wanted to touch on before we have to sign off?
We, Bruce and I, wrote a book called Into the Desert. No, sorry, we have a lot of books that I lose track of how many things I've written. We wrote a book about this virtual network of Numenera called the Datasphere, and it's basically your character can upload yourself into this like in Tron. And so, if you want to have some craziest, fully digital adventures, I tell people, if you have a favorite video game that you like, or there's like an encounter or a level from a video game that you like, you can have your characters in your game upload themselves into this, into a game arena, just kind of like how the Light Cycle was a game arena, and they can play through that scenario, and then they download themselves back into their physical bodies and go back to their normal adventures. They do that at a location called Avertice, and I am making a collection of encounter-based write-ups for more vertices where people can go into or out of the Datasphere that have some other quirks to them. And I'm working on this Talos conversion that Bruce and I are wrapping up for 5e and for Cypher System. Just if you want to see what I'm doing, keep an eye on the Monty Cook Games Twitter, on my personal Twitter, which is Sean K. Reynolds. And my general advice for people who are playing, if anybody new is listening, don't be afraid to make mistakes with the rules. I have been playing video game, or probably been playing role-playing games for 20, 25 years, and I've done streaming games, and I've gotten rules wrong on games that I've written during the stream. I've been called out on it. It's okay. If we have time to make one funny anecdote, when I was a teenager and I was running a D&D game, I had a situation where the PCs were on one side of a mountain range, they need to get to the other side. And I was thinking they were just going to go up over the mountains, which would take a day. They said, nope, we're going to go the long route this way. I hadn't expected them to do that. And so I was just rolling for random encounters along the way. And I'm like, oh, random encounter? No roll. Yeah, no encounter. This day passes uneventfully. This day passes uneventfully. And so after like 20 minutes of this, my players were passing notes to each other, and one of them said, and Sean's world passes uneventfully. It's okay to do, like, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to do something where there's like, this is 20 minutes of boredom. It's okay, you just pick up, move on, and just, you can hand wave things, screw up, we're all human. Nobody expects you to be perfect, and it's a crazy world right now, so just play and have fun.
That is really great advice. Honestly, Dan and I, Dan mentioned this show that we're working on called The Big Bad, and I think we do a Tuesday night stream where we talk about just the making of that show, and I think we've decided to devote an entire episode of that, of all the things we've gotten wrong, right? Because we have definitely hosed the rules more than once.
Yeah.
And I think the good news is on the balance, it kind of comes out as a wash. Like, right. Every team got a gimme from us accidentally somehow because, you know, it's all.
We're humans.
We're humans. Yeah, and the rules are complicated, man.
Yeah. I think that's great.
Even video games have rules. Telling us.
It's true. It's true. Yeah. Some that we have worked on.
Awesome. Well, that about wraps up our time. Viewers, if you have any thoughts, questions, comments on any of the stuff that Sean has brought up today, obviously, as mentioned, I think at the beginning of this, there's just such a mountain of stuff we wanted to talk to you about, Sean, that I'm sure we only barely scraped the surface. So leave us some comments here in the video and or contact Sean directly, as he said, over on Twitter. And tell us what you think.
Yep. And we definitely look forward to additional comments on this. Remember that if you're new to the show, you can like, follow, subscribe to us. Basically, any kind of social media service. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Facebook, each of them under the title Wandering DMs.
Our show is also available as an audio-only podcast, which you can find on our website at wanderingdams.com, as well as many fine podcast carriers such as Google Podcasts and iTunes and Spotify. If you're listening to us on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us. That helps us out a lot.
It definitely does. And as usual, big thanks to our patrons who support the show. We could not possibly do all the things that we're doing on Wandering DMs these days without your support. We have a subscriber drive going right on. We've had new patrons sign up in the last week, and we cannot thank you enough for that. If you would like to join our patrons in supporting Wandering DMs, please go to patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see our different tiers and what you can possibly whatever you can do to support. New benefits that we've rolled out recently, actually, to patrons. We have a private Discord server that we chat on from time to time, frequently after a show, as a matter of fact. Coupons for reduced rates on our merchandise for Wandering DMs, and other things that are coming out soon. What have I missed, Paul?
Probably a lot. I wouldn't worry about it.
That's true. Look for other shows coming up. Yeah, as Paul just said a couple minutes ago, we'll have our Tuesday debrief from our work on The Big Bad coming up Tuesday night. Paul has his D&D Warhammer mashup 10 Dead Rats coming up on Thursday. My war game show with Isabel is currently on hiatus. That's probably not happening this week. Next week we'll be back with a discussion about how much potion can you drink in a round and related topic. And then in 2 weeks we'll be back, and our next guest will be James Malazuski from Grandiardia. Will be with us in 2 weeks, as a matter of fact. John, thank you so much for being with us today. Please look for Sean's products that are on Monte Cook Games. You can go to Monte Cook Games online, their store, or other stores online. Look on Twitter for Sean himself at Sean K. Reynolds, all one word. And I personally will be really looking forward to Beasts of Flesh and Steel and other stuff coming from Sean about Numera. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Absolutely.
We appreciate it. We will be back talk show next Sunday, as always, Sunday talk show 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again then for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.